all busy. We're all juggling work, a social life, a secret identity as a web-slinging superhero who is single-handedly lowering the crime rate of a city of 8 million people. You know, life. Most of us don't have time to think about where our coffee comes from. We barely have time to launder the suit we wear under our regular clothes to be ever prepared in case our help is needed. But that no longer means that you need to sacrifice quality, convenience, and ethical consumption, because Sparkplug is here to help. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf, half-calf, and your next new favorite. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this exceptional coffee to your home or office within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor, and you will taste the difference. You can order Sparkplug as you need it, or join the Sparkplug Autopilot Coffee Club for regular deliveries and never run out of fresh coffee again. If you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, and that's all one word, the number 100, Sparkplug will give you 10% off your next coffee order. That applies to any size order, and you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. Swing on over to sparkplugcoffee.com to get started.
Go Web Go! Shazam!
Top 100 Project
and action.
Hey to one and all, and thank you kindly for devouring the next 155 Project, the endless classic movies podcast that goggles at all kinds of pictures that move. This thing started in March 2013 when we decided to review the 123 titles on the AFI's 1998 and 2007 groupings of most outstanding American films. So go back and listen to any or all of those to hear us when we weren't as good as we are now. We like to think we're good now. Maybe we're not good now either. I don't know. We don't apologize for spoiling flicks, so be warned about that now. I'm the misunderstood supervillain with smart arms and a dad bod, Ryan Ellis. And here's the lady who never has rent money and whose costume rides up in the crotch a little bit, my wife, Bev.
That's me.
By the way, in the coffee sponsor, your voice was a little bit too low.
You gotta be a little higher to be Tobey Maguire.
Well, he's not really doing that, but he's not quite, what is it, the character from The Simpsons. His voice isn't quite cracking.
It's pretty close.
Well, that leads into my coming attractions trivia, because as good as he might be in these movies, and I think we're going to rave about him a little bit, there's been better casting as far as young goes, which is what Spider-Man, I guess, is supposed to be, as a younger character. So anyway, here's the trivia. Which of the three actors, well, this is actually an opinion, which of the three actors who played Spider-Man in Marvel movies, Tobey Maguire, Andrew Garfield, and Tom Holland, is the best at it, Tom Holland, and which of his many villains, all the Spider-Man villains, do you think is the best?
So I do have a soft spot for Tobey Maguire's Spider-Man, because I just have a soft spot for this movie entirely, yeah. And I do, you
he's
know,
like a kid.
Not everyone agrees with me, but I think he's excellent casting, but Tom Holland. Oh, I've never seen either of the Andrew Garfield Spider-Man movies, but Tom Holland is the best Spider-Man. He is absolutely outstanding.
He's an A+. I don't know much about the comics. I watched the animated series long ago. I think maybe it was more of an adult voice that did for that. I think there may have been a lot of versions of Spider-Man on TV, but the one I remember was an adult voice. But anyway, the character that I know, and again, not a comic fan, I've never even read a Spider-Man comic. I'm not a nerd, I guess, sort of, is Tom Holland. Unbelievable casting, right from the Captain America Civil War trailer. When he comes in, does the Spider-Man thing, steals Cap's shield. Hey, everyone. We all seem to think, there you go, there's the guy. And this is the actor from The Impossible, the oldest son.
When he was a kid.
Yeah, he was 14 or something, 12, whatever age it was.
He blew us away.
Naomi Watts was nominated for an Oscar for that performance and should have been. She was terrific too, but he's the best thing in that whole movie. Ewan McGregor's good in that. The other two kids are good in that. But Tom Holland stood out, and then maybe that's why he got the Spider-Man role. And look at him killing it in, I think, maybe four movies at this point with Spider-Man Far From Home coming out on July 5th.
He has so much charisma, and he's such a great physical actor in the Spider-Man movies. I don't even think that he shows his full range of talent that he did show when he was just, like you said, 13, 14 years old in The Impossible, which is that he is an exceptional, very deep actor. And I don't know if you've ever seen it, Ryan, but he has the best lip sync battle. He does this unbelievable dance to Rihanna's Umbrella on Lip Sync Challenge. He's amazing. This man is so talented. They're lucky to have cast him in this part.
He's only 23 now, and he's been in these Marvel movies for quite a few years, like I said, in Civil War, and then two of his own movies, and also, of course, so five movies total now in the Marvel Universe. Maguire was in 3 in the Sam Raimi Marvel universe, because they were Marvel movies, I guess. Well, not the way we think of them now, but they were Marvel movies. And then Garfield did too. Andrew Garfield is a talented enough actor, but I think he was the wrong casting. He is too old. Maguire was very good, but Holland's an A+. Anyway, my favorite villain, I don't think you said that yet, but Willem Dafoe, I think, from the first Spider-Man is a great villain, because for one thing, Green Goblin is a classic Spider-Man villain. I think Dafoe nailed it. And he's in this movie a little bit, Spider-Man 2. And he's also in a little bit of Spider-Man 3. But Alfred Molina as Doc Ock in this and Michael Keaton in Spider-Man Homecoming are right behind him.
I would say of all the Spider-Man movies I've seen, I've never seen a straight-up bad villain, except I guess actually maybe Venom, in a sense that they just messed up the story so badly in Spider-Man 3.
Jamie Foxx, I think it's what is Electro in The Amazing Spider-Man 2, not very good.
Of the ones I've seen, I don't know if I've really seen a great villain yet.
Trick question, even though my answer's already been given. His best villain might be Thanos, because he's in Infinity War and he's in Endgame.
And Thanos is a hell of a villain. Doc Ock is good because he's a pretty sympathetic villain.
Yeah.
He has actually the exact same arc as the Green Goblin, that they're both scientists that go mad with their own creations. I can't remember what happens to the Green Goblin, but isn't he poisoned or something? Or
just like his son Harry. I watched Spider-Man 3 a few days ago to prepare for this, because I had not seen that movie since it came out in 2007, and it's been ripped apart by a lot of people, even though it basically succeeded. It isn't great, but we do see Harry has been ingesting the same, not toxin, but the same Green Goblin thing that helped make Norman Osborn in the first movie, The Green Goblin. Because he wasn't just a guy who had a sled and a helmet and a vendetta. He was somebody with performance-enhancing drugs who was making himself go insane. Now, in Spider-Man 3, when Harry, as the new Green Goblin, attacks Spider-Man and then loses the battle, he takes one hell of a fall. And it makes you wonder, how is he impervious to that kind of pain? Which is also true about Doc Ock in this. The arms are impervious to anything, basically. But his body isn't, and he takes some serious abuse right in his first fight with Spider-Man, where he gets bashed into a cab and just shakes it off. His body should be a human body like mine or yours, where somebody punches you and, oh my God, I have a headache and a concussion and I need to go to the hospital. But he's able to take everything from Spider-Man, who's not quite Superman, but almost impervious to everything. We've seen that in the whole Spider-Man arc, where he's so tough. But anyway, that's all the heroes and villains set up. The creatively named Spider-Man 2. That was back when you could say 2 and 3 and 4. Now it's got to be, you don't number them so people don't feel like they missed out if they didn't see one of the other ones. I've heard that recently from people. That's why you don't really hear numbers in sequels anymore. But anyway, Spider-Man 2 was released just a few days shy of 15 years ago by Columbia, before they were Marvel, because Spider-Man is now Marvel's property, on June 30th, 2004. And money was made, although we'll talk about that a little bit more with the Spider-Man movies, all of them, in a few minutes. But before we do, Bev, give people the rundown again on Spider-Man 2 with the Skinner.
Tobey Maguire is Spider-Man. You've probably heard of him. And he's having a hard time juggling school, work, a social life, and all those pesky responsibilities that come with great power. Power that is becoming increasingly unreliable. So he quits. But bad timing, because Alfred Molina's Dr. Octavius has just had his brains taken over by his own artificially intelligent tentacle arms and is determined to replicate a failed experiment that threatens to nuke New York.
I'm Spider-Man no more. The visual of that is based on a comic.
Cover.
The actual cover of the comic, yeah. Or, in a nutshell, mutated teenager loses superpowers and regains them when it's convenient to the plot.
I think the idea is that he's psychosomatically losing his powers because he's losing his gusto.
Which doesn't make sense. Either you have these powers you never asked for because you're bitten by a spider, or you don't.
Can't you psychosomatically have all kinds of things happen? It's a superhero movie.
He needs superhero Viagra, I guess.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Because he is impotent more than once in this movie, but then he gets his powers back, and I'm back, I'm back! Bang! My back!
Which apparently was a joke about the fact that Tobey Maguire was having genuine terrible back problems at the time and tried to postpone the shooting of the film so that he could recover. I think he had surgery, but they couldn't, and so that was kind of like an in-joke between him and Raimi.
Also, that apparently he was using that as an excuse to try to get more money out of them. And Jake Gyllenhaal was lined up, and it sounds like he was almost about to be Spider-Man in this movie after Maguire had been Spider-Man in the first movie and just missed out in the end because they settled. Maguire still made a lot of money. And now Gyllenhaal will be Mysterio in the movie coming out in a few days, which apparently is a hero but may be a villain. We don't really know yet. Okay, there's a lot of numbers for Spider-Man 2. Let's get them out of the way right now. Rotten Tomatoes. 93% of critics like this movie. 253 fresh, 18 rotten, for an average of 8.3 out of 10. Those are outstanding numbers, and 82% of audiences. The critics actually like the movie more than the audiences did. Yeah. How about that? It was second at the 2004 U.S. box office. Shrek 2 was number one. Fahrenheit 9/11, which we covered last year, the year before, it was last year, was 17th. And Million Dollar Baby, which Chris and I covered a few weeks ago, was 24th. So Spider-Man 2 is 64th on Box Office Mojo's top 300 adjusted for inflation, which is still pretty strong considering how many movies keep leapfrogging everything because of more theaters, because of the fact that tickets cost more money and there's more human beings going to movies. And that's, of course, domestic. I should maybe start talking about this worldwide because that is mattering more and more. China is the market, but I still mostly talk domestic. The first Spider-Man in 2002 is 41st on the Box Office Mojo list, and Spider-Man 3 is 114th, which is still pretty impressive. But look at that, 41st, 64th, 114th. That is opposite of what you often see with these series. I think Pirates of the Caribbean, around that same time, and Shrek as well, they built and built and built. Maybe they crested at some point with one of the sequels and then came back down a little bit more, but they didn't go down the whole time. Let's continue with that trend, because when Andrew Garfield took over, not that it's Garfield's fault exactly, or the director or anything else, but anyway, when he became Spider-Man, the movies dropped even more. If you look on Box Office Mojo, the first three Spider-Man movies with Maguire were bigger than the two Garfield ones. And then the Holland rebound when he was in Homecoming, which isn't as big as the original Spider-Man movies, the first or second, but it's definitely bigger than the Garfield ones, and better too. I think of all the six movies, because we have not seen, of course, Far From Home yet, the standalones, not including Spider-Man being in the Avengers films. Homecoming is probably my favorite, if it's not better than Spider-Man 2 or Spider-Man 1.
Are you
it's
not
right there.
Counting Into the Spider-Verse in this?
No, you're right.
There's a lot of competition for the best Spider-Man movie because there are so many really good Spider-Man movies.
I forgot all about that. I should have included
something about
that.
His character. Yeah, they've hit it out of the park so many times, but it's hard to say which is my favorite because Into the Spider-Verse is so different in so many ways. It's truly this special standalone thing, but I think it's just a work of art.
So Spider-Man 2, Spider-Verse, and Homecoming, I guess it'd be neck and neck.
Yeah, I liked Homecoming a lot. I don't have anything bad to say about it, but it's not really in competition for my favorite Spider-Man movie. It's Spider-Man 2 versus Into the Spider-Verse.
Okay.
Spider-Man 2, I just have more of a personal connection with, and that I just really loved it when it came out. It came out when I was young and way more into popcorn movies, and I watched it over and over again. And
I liked it, maybe not as much as other people, but I think it's a terrific film, for sure. A few more bona fides. It won one Oscar, the Visual Effects Award, and that included John Dykstra, who was part of the Star Wars team way back in 1977. So it was his second Oscar ever, and he is the one that accepts when they won. I looked it up earlier today. And it's interesting, he mentions, thank God Lord of the Rings didn't make a movie that year, because they've won three straight. And then I believe King Kong, which is Peter Jackson's team again, won the year after Spider-Man 2. Spider-Man 2 was also nominated for sound and the sound effects. And here again, we talked about it with Speed, and I mentioned other films that either have won or been nominated for those same two awards. Jurassic Park, Terminator 2, Cliffhanger, now Spider-Man 2, were nominated for those same awards. A little bit more, Spider-Man 2 was actually nominated for the AFI's Top 100 list in 2007.
It was?
And the first one was not. That is one of the rare examples, maybe the only example, where the sequel is nominated but not the first one.
Well, if they made another list now, which I don't think they're going to do, then for sure that would be true of Dark Knight.
I think the same year actually now, could be wrong about this, but Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban.
Ooh, yeah, another great sequel that's better than its two predecessors.
And maybe the first two predecessors are considered English films, but regardless, I think Azkaban was nominated and they weren't. And then Spider-Man 2 was also nominated for the Top 100 Cheers, most inspiring, and the Top 100 Genres in the Fantasy category.
Wow.
So a lot of big numbers, bona fides, and everything else. All right, so all of that. What do you think? I know you love it, but tell everyone what you think about Spider-Man Dose.
Yeah, I kind of gave it away, but this one's a big one for me. It is beginning to look a little bit dated now, particularly the special effects, which were state-of-the-art at the time. But the tone, the energy, the pathos of Spider-Man 2 has always been the perfect formula for a popcorn film for me. It's genuinely really funny. It's also joyful and irreverent without ever losing its emotional stakes. It's not perfect. It's too busy. There's a lot of wasted setup that never pays off and takes time away from the main story. It kind of loses focus here and there. But I forgive it because it's just so damn entertaining.
You should watch Spider-Man 3 if you want to look for things oh, that dude, don't pay off
I know,
or work out.
I know.
Way too many villains. It's funny because one of the writers on this, Alvin Sargent, a 2-time Oscar winner, in fact, that they recruited to work on, I don't know if he worked on the first one, but this one anyway, and I think he worked on the third one on this movie. He said they had too many costumes because they wanted to have other villains. Kurt Connors is in this. Dylan Baker, who is so great in Happiness and a lot of films. He's been in a ton of movies over the years. His arc is actually the one they gave Otto Octavius, the mentor who's trying to do scientific good, who's not a villain in any obvious way, but that's the arc they gave to Doc Ock. And we never do see the Lizard in this series. We see him in The Amazing Spider-Man, the first villain for Andrew Garfield's character. That's when Rhys Ifans played him. But Kurt Connors, Dylan Baker, never gets to play the Lizard. He's one of Spider-Man's more iconic villains.
I was disappointed, too, because I'm a Dylan Baker fan. I think he's an actor that should have been much bigger than he was.
We might have seen more of him in this movie and more of him in a villainous role or even a build-up to it. Except Alvin Sargent said too many costumes, and then they really went that way in the third one with way too many villains. Sandman's the one you can really get rid of. There's some good pathos in that, granted. There's also some really stupid things. Talk about reasonably good questions, which for the first time in a while I have for this movie. We'll get to them a little later on. But in the third movie, there's so many with the Sandman alone. It really should have been, and this movie sets it up so well, the arc should have been that Harry in the third movie is Spider-Man's rival. If you want to have one other villain, maybe, but not three.
I heard they knew they were only going to make one more movie, and Raimi's favorite villain in the comics was always Sandman. So that's why he insisted on pushing him in there. And then there was pressure from the studio to do Venom. All the setup they did in Spider-Man 2, and it's disappointing to watch it. It really goes nowhere. They waste all this time with these characters. Wolfman, of course, Mary Jane's fiancé, is a character that goes on to become the villain Wolfman in the comics.
Which is also a plot thread that never pays off in this trilogy.
Yeah, exactly. And the Lizard.
Her fiancé, John Jameson, is J. Jonah Jameson's son.
You know, it's a city of 8 million people, and everybody knows each other in these movies.
Which
like,
I guess
everybody.
Is true to the comics, though, isn't it? I don't know.
Oh,
I think that's true.
And it's like a silly comic book movie, so you just forgive this kind of stuff.
Well, that's true. In fact, we have an opening credit sequence that shows events from the first movie, very comic booky, shows how we got to the present. I think they do the same thing in the third one, show sequences from the first and second movies. And then there's very comic booky scenes in this and shots and whatever else with the dialogue, the bags of money sequence when Doc Ock is robbing a bank. The way that all plays out is so much like a comic book. The exposition that happens in the movie, which is the one weakness of the Batman Begins, the year after this, had some of the same issues, maybe even problems, because Batman Begins, as good as it might be, when I've seen it in more recent years, I think, oh my God, guys, that dialogue is bad.
Dude,
for a movie that's otherwise terrific, the dialogue in that. And this movie is close to being on that same level of not greatness. Also, big close-ups. Watching Spider-Man 3, I noticed a moment where Sandman turns, I think it's before he becomes Sandman. Anyway, he turns to the camera in his right side profile, and I think Doc Ock has the exact same close-up in this movie. I guess they're trying to make callbacks from one movie to another. Anyway, so Peter's our main character. Peter Parker, Spider-Man. What a great comic book hero. Maybe the greatest one of all time. Batman and Superman are certainly on that list, but Spider-Man is the favorite for so many people. And in this movie, he has it rough. He loses his pizza job in the opening sequence. He's working so hard, and yet still can't get that pizza there on time. He's in debt to the Daily Bugle. He's working for them. It should be another job he has, but he actually is in back pay to them because they gave him advances, and he's also struggling in school, where he is brilliant, but he's not doing the work, so he's not getting the results.
You know, when you asked me who the best villain in Spider-Man series was...
Life?
I considered saying just life in general, because the burden of everyday life is truly the villain, because he just can't do it all. He isn't Bruce Wayne. He doesn't have the Wayne billions to finance his superpower and give him the means and the luxury of time to
what
be
you say?
A superhero full-time.
That's offensive.
It's painfully realistic that
he's doing his best, man.
No one could be a working student with a social life and still fight crime. It's a logistical nightmare, and he ends up failing at everything. And I think anybody, especially anybody who doesn't come from money, has had some time in their life when they can very deeply relate to this. That might be part of the reason why this is one of my favorite superhero movies, because I've been... not that broke, but I've been broke before.
I think that's also true to the comic book that Spider-Man, Peter Parker, is struggling just to get by in a basic kind of way. Unlike Tony Stark and Bruce Wayne you mentioned, and then the people that have superhuman abilities, which Spidey has also, but he still has to live a normal life and then conceal that normal life. And he can't be with the love of his life, Mary Jane. He's infatuated with her. And Kirsten Dunst, who I'm going to talk about in a few days with Chris when we do Bring It On, a cheerleading movie. Yep, we're doing a cheerleading movie for Scoring at the Movies. But we've seen a lot of her in recent years because you and I did Melancholia as well. And I've just seen her. I watched Spider-Man 3, of course. She might be one of the more underrated actresses, now that I look at her filmography, in the history of the business, and certainly the more recent years. Maybe not so much in these movies. She's okay, I guess.
I think she's a better actress than people give her credit for, but I don't love her as Mary Jane.
But here's my first reasonably good question. Peter pines for MJ, and that's fine. That's true to the comics. But what about Miss Brandt? Elizabeth Banks, one of the greats in the business. Or even the gawky Ursula, who's infatuated with him.
They actually seem like they would make a cute, good match. She's funny, too.
Mm. And then, of course, the landlord. He's got some funny moments. He's in the next movie. They both are in Spider-Man 3. A lot of characters maintain all the way through. It's actually interesting. They got James Franco and Dunstan McGuire and Rosemary Harris, who's Aunt May. Cliff Robertson, I think, is in the third movie. He's definitely in this movie in a flashback sequence. And I think Defoe is in all of them, at least in some sequences here and there. And then also Elizabeth Banks and J. Jonah Jameson himself. My man, J.K. Simmons, who is so perfectly cast.
And he was not a household name, to say the least, when this movie came out.
No, and then 10 years later, he wins the Oscar for Whiplash, which I think we're going to cover later this year, one of my favorites of the more recent era. Some of the best casting in the history of the business compared to the comic book and then the movie itself. And he's also played Commissioner Gordon on the more recent Justice League movies.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Which is so odd, but so many people do carry over. Michael Keaton was Batman, and he's a great Spider-Man villain, so a Marvel villain, and in the more recent Marvel movies. At this point, Spider-Man 2, yes, it's a Marvel movie, but it is Columbia's picture. We don't think of it as Marvel, per se. But if you're in one of the more recent movies, then yeah, you're Marvel DC, head-to-head, bang, bang, bang. And a lot of people have crossed over into both of them. Or in some cases, you get people that are in multiple types of movies. You get Star Wars people that go on to Marvel movies that might also be in Pixar movies or Disney movies or what have you. And sometimes, of course, they do cross over. But back to the MJ thing. Her acting career is taking off, and she walks around unnoticed, which is interesting for a person who's so heavily promoted. But it is New York City, and it does remind me of that line that somebody said a long time ago about people that want to be actors in New York City, thousands of people in acting school and whatnot. Go outside, look around, and there's 10 people more talented than you are, no matter who you are.
She's also a theater actress. Mm-hmm. She has a billboard, but it's not the same as being in movies or TV.
Yeah, and you're in New York, so you just blend in.
Yeah, that too.
So you didn't love her performance in this, and I think she's fine in this role because they wrote it the way that they did. It's always nice that she's wet so often.
Dude, there's always something blowing her skirt up, or she's upside down.
Showing off her body quite nicely.
She's adorable, and you can't help but understand why he's in love with her. But she's underwritten as a character. Actually, there's been 15 years of superhero movies, and it's become the lexicon of our culture, and it's amazing to go back and see the amount of faith these films give to their audience versus movies today. It's alarming how hard the script works to over-explain every single beat of this film. There's virtually no emotion or plot point too small or obvious for a character to state it out loud over and over, no matter how awkward it is to say out loud. Harry's really bad for this. Every time he's on screen, he's just like, I hate Spider-Man. Spider-Man killed my father. This experiment is gonna make me a millionaire. This experiment has ruined me. MJ is certainly very guilty of this, where she's constantly saying out loud what's really perfectly obvious. They externalize their thoughts rather than trusting the audience to remember what their motives are. Compare this to even something like Avengers Endgame. It's not the world's most subtle movie by a long shot, but it gives the audience a great deal of credit to follow a rather convoluted plot with dozens of characters. And I think it represents an evolution in the audience, who has now been primed by so many comic book movies that we no longer need to be spoon-fed. I would argue we never need to be spoon-fed, but I guess part of the pleasure of watching a good popcorn flick is that it never really asks you to do any of the heavy lifting. This movie really does dumb it down. Do you agree that watching this older movie just feels more simplified?
Yeah, and I think I have to give credit again to Spencer Gilbert of the Screen Junkies guys, Fandom Entertainment they're called now, because he's the one that said the Marvel movies, and this isn't really a Marvel movie, but it is in a way, the more recent ones, starting with Iron Man until what we're up to now, which will be in a few days.
The Feige years.
Yeah, the Kevin Feige years. You said Feige. The
Sorry.
Kevin Feige years, not Feige. I said it wrong, too. Feige. What are you, British? Kevin Feige. Anyway, he has said it's like watching your favorite series, as in TV series. Really well produced, big budget, but TV series, because there are a lot of things you can get out of this if you're a comic book fan that you won't otherwise, and there's a lot of things you won't get out of this if you don't stay on top of every single one of the movies. I've seen all of the recent Marvel movies. I think I've seen every Marvel movie, period. Not the TV shows that are on Netflix, and I guess they'll soon be on Disney Prime, or Disney Plus, whatever the hell they call it. Yeah, they probably have more faith in their audience in general, and maybe that is credit to Feige, because he is the one that oversees most of this. I think we talked about this recently. I forget what it was now. where he is the one that oversees all the Marvel films, and he has to answer to the head of Disney, at least, Bob Iger. But maybe that's about it. And he's the one that can work with these writers and directors and producers on all the individual movies and say, this is the vision that we have set out. So live up to that. And our audience will keep up because we keep on making hits. They obviously are with us. And at this point, though, Spider-Man, not just Spider-Man, but comic book movies had been waning because Batman Forever, which actually was pretty good, and Batman and Robin, which was not. Then you get the X-Men movies, which were pretty good, and they got better as they went along. This is 2 years after X-Men 2.
Which is the best X-Men movie.
The first Spider-Man movie was a monster. So they were still, in some ways, finding their footing. Batman Begins with Warner Brothers and DC, a year after this, was also finding its footing. That was a big hit. And, of course, The Dark Knight. So maybe at this point, before the comic book movies really took over the way they have for about 11 years now, with Iron Man, The Dark Knight, and then as the next several years came along with the Marvel movies, mostly and some DC, they gave more credit to their audience generally than they did back at this point.
Part of it has got to be that they've realized that their real market is adults. Young adults. But they don't need to make movies assuming their audience is a bunch of 12-year-olds. They can assume that they're at least college age.
I don't think that the more recent movies have used a line from the Spider-Man lexicon that, of course, is in the first Spider-Man movie with Maguire. And it's mentioned again in this movie. I think you see Cliff Robertson say it again.
You
He's
do.
In a cameo in this movie, just like Willem Dafoe's in a cameo in this movie. Where he says, with great power comes great responsibility. I think they avoid it specifically in the Garfield version and now the Holland version. They may have lines that infer it, but you don't actually hear it anymore.
The whole theme of all three movies is him struggling with the responsibilities that come with his power.
Which is a lesson for anybody, because if you have power when it comes to financial power in our real world, you have responsibility. And way too many people, let's get political now, but way too many people don't seem to care about that responsibility at all. But Spider-Man is more aware of it than most other comic book characters have ever been.
Even Doc Ock is swayed by the same maxim. He says, with great intelligence comes great responsibility, because he's trying to convince Peter Parker that he needs to pursue science and stop being distracted by everything else that's going on. And it's kind of an interesting perspective that they don't dive into, that while Peter is pursuing Spider-Man and being a hero, he's neglecting the other sides of him that could contribute to the world, namely that he's a talented science student.
And then Doc Ock, towards the end, might kill half of New York City with his experiments. And I do have to ask this question, not quite reasonably good, but a question. Maybe he really is a hack. Is it possible he's a hack? And that, yes, he's very brilliant and very talented, but also does careless research.
Yeah, yeah.
So he's not somebody who's at the level of an Einstein. He's more of a B-plus player.
The thing that he invented to help him with his main project is actually a way better, more successful accomplishment.
The arms.
The arms. The artificial intelligence.
Just like the talking
arms.
Dogs and Up.
Yes!
Forget about the damn bird. You've got talking dogs.
You made dogs talk. Nobody would ever forget your name if you just took this invention back to America and sold it as a product.
Just like make these arms safe, because, of course, one of the things that happens is that his inhibitor chip gets blown out really easily, actually. A little bit of an overload. We see Daniel Day-Kim, the same year, would star in Lost. One of the many cameos.
Yeah,
it wasn't a cameo, I guess, at that point, because he wasn't known.
Like, I think he had been in maybe Buffy before. I could be wrong about that. But yeah, you already mentioned Elizabeth Banks, Daniel Day-Kim, Asif Manvi's in this movie. Joel McHale is the banker. Emily Deschanel is in it. And Hal Sparks, who some people might know as the lead from Queer as Folk.
And also Ted Raimi, who's in, I think, all three movies.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He's from Xena as well.
Yeah, because Sam Raimi is a big producer and did that, and that's Sam Raimi's brother is Ted. He's Hoffman. He's always just appearing in The Office. One nice touch in this film as well is that Bill Nunn, who I believe is in all the Spider-Man movies, this trilogy, as Joseph Robbie Robertson, not the band, he seems to know who Spider-Man is. Just like when Spider-Man talks to his doctor, well, as Peter Parker talks to his doctor, and the doctor seems to get it. Your friend, Spider-Man. And when Robbie at one point looks at Peter, yeah, Spider-Man. Where's Spider-Man to help out now, huh? Spider-Man no more, huh, Pete?
May have been another setup they just never made good on.
But he clearly seems to know who he's talking to, that the photographer that J. Jonah Jameson doesn't like is actually J. Jonah Jameson's nemesis, because in fake news, he's always saying in the Daily Bugle that Spider-Man is a menace, until he finally says, where is Spider-Man to save us? That's actually a funny sequence. Spider-Man steals the suit back when he got his powers back. And he's back to being a menace again!
This is an extremely funny movie, but it would be impossible to exaggerate how funny J.K. Simmons is.
His timing is outstanding, and he works well with Banks as his secretary. She is terrific.
Yeah, his energy, he's so manic.
One of the things they do in the first movie is that he's got to calm down because he has a heart condition, so she's always on the intercom. Your wife's online, whatever it is. All right, keep calm. Take a pill. Not that one. Not that one either. There are some good things in Spider-Man 3. Now, let's get back to Doc Ock, because he is, along with Spider-Man himself, I guess, maybe the best thing in the movie. Well, actually, maybe Doc Ock is the very best thing in this movie. The tritium that he wants, it's a real element.
Yeah,
I was surprised to read that. I thought it was just something made up, but I guess it's a real thing. And then Spidey's villains, along with himself for that matter, with the bite back in the first movie, always seem to be victims of science going wrong.
It's a science-y-based comic book. He's a science student.
They're
tragic, like mad scientists.
They're tragic heroes because Doc Ock doesn't want to be a bad guy, and at the end he is redeemed. Not really true, the Green Goblin in the first film, but then Harry becomes a bad guy in Spider-Man 3, but is redeemed and ends up fighting with Peter in 3 against Venom and Sandman. We do see that vicious assault in the operating room where Doc Ock is knocked out. The movie tries to make clear, I was reading that they try to make it clear at least, I don't know if it's fully clear, but I always got the idea that Doc Ock is out. Otto Octavius is not trying to do this stuff because he had the accident and the arms are doing what they're doing to all the doctors and nurses and just ravaging them. You gotta know that Sam Raimi, the Evil Dead guy,
yeah.
So he made the Evil Dead trilogy and then many years later it is a Spider-Man trilogy, wanted to show blood and guts so badly, but it's a PG film, so it suggests a lot worse than it really is.
And it's a very Sam Raimi scene. That scene in particular is where he indulged his Evil Dead side of him, and there's all these wacky, fun camera effects where they're attached to the arms and...
The chainsaw.
The chainsaw, of course! That's just so Sam Raimi. He really put so much of himself into these films.
And the reason why this movie won visual effects, probably the train sequence is a big part of it, but generally Doc Ock... with the combination of real tentacles and visual effects. And we talked about them in T2 many years ago, that one of the best things about T2, as impressive as the effects are, especially for the dawning of CGI, because that was still really new at that point, was the fact that a lot of the time, you don't think about it until you hear on the commentary or really look closely, that some of the things are not CGI. It's people using puppets. Or we talked on T2 about how at one point when the T-1000 is supposed to have the metal arm, it's just tinfoil wrapped around the arm.
There's only a total of 2.5 minutes of digital special effects in T2.
Probably more than that, but it's not dominant in the movie the way it would be in the more modern movies. Probably not that dominant in this film, because I guess whenever they'd have close-ups with the arms, they'd be puppeting them. But when they had wide shots, especially if Doc Ock was climbing up buildings, fighting Spider-Man, that kind of thing, then it's all visual effects. Of course, he's real, but the arms aren't real.
This was the first time we really got to see Spidey swinging from buildings in a way that felt realistic and exciting and kinetic.
Better than in 2002 Spider-Man, where I remember Roger Ebert especially said it didn't feel like it was real. He loved this movie, I think, but he thought that one didn't feel like Spider-Man was really swinging down in the cavernous parts of New York City streets. That sequence they show in the trailer, of course, when he's fighting Ock when they're on the subway train, the elevated train, I guess, and he's on the street and somehow it's such a quick shot in the trailer, but in the movie it gives a little bit more text to what's going on, where he's on his back but using his web, so he's basically skateboarding in a way. But a quick shot in the trailer, you think, how is that happening? But in the movie, it makes a lot more sense. Yeah, the movie does feel like it's got more weight, for sure. And when he's swinging around, there's a lot of visual effects shots of Spider-Man swinging through, I think, in the opening, of course, at the very end as well. The last shot is him swinging off to try to fight another crime.
And they're very exciting. The way it's done is effective and fun.
But Peter does lose his powers at times in this movie. Kind of out of nowhere. First time is after he misses MJ's play, and then it seems to be mental. But if he's losing his powers, then how can he handle crashing and burning after such long falls without dying or at least having serious injuries? His sight is not what it once was. In the first movie, when he's got the Spider-Man abilities, he doesn't need glasses anymore. But in this movie, for a while, he needs the glasses again. So clearly his body is not what it once was. So if he falls from hundreds of feet in the air and lands on top of a skyscraper and the air conditioning system, whatever it was, how is he not dead?
That's a question with most superhero movies. People who have no superpowers get crushed under buildings that have exploded. And
including
they just
Doc Ock.
Push the bricks off of them and get up like nothing happened. They don't even have, yeah, they don't have bruises, literally.
I guess in the sequence where he says he's Spider-Man no more and leaves his costume behind, which some other guy finds, a guy from A Simple Plan, which incidentally I still think is Sam Raimi's best film. We reviewed that last year.
It's the least Sam Raimi-ish Sam Raimi film.
Absolutely, but I think it's his best movie. Yeah. But Brent Briscoe, who is Lou in that film, is the one who sells the costume to J. Jonah Jameson. But when Spider-Man does give up and leaves the costume in the alley, that alley is supposedly where he first kissed MJ, the upside-down kiss. Which, for some reason, I didn't notice two things people talk about so much now. That Rachel and Friends and MJ in these movies is always braless. And certainly in the sequence when they kiss in the first movie, Upside Down in the Rain, wow. Kirsten Dunst. But how about Aunt May? Because she's a big part of this movie, too. Rosemary Harris, who's fine. I actually prefer Marissa Tomei in the more recent movies.
For obvious reasons or for other reasons? Because she's hot?
She seems to be better casting for an aunt in some ways. Because Marissa Tomei is 50-ish, whatever she is. Maybe
she's like the right age to be his aunt.
She doesn't seem like she's 80-ish, that Rosemary Harris seems in these films.
It feels like a very realistic family, actually, the new Spider-Man films.
Yeah.
Their connection, I agree with you, it seems less cartoonishy.
I did love Cliff Robertson in the first film, and we knew where his character was going if you know anything about the Spider-Man arc. And by the way, I'm looking at the IMDb credits right now, seeing Bill Nunn's character is Joseph Robertson. And of course, Cliff Robertson plays Uncle Ben Parker. But Rosemary Harris is Aunt May. She's strong because she slips off an umbrella and manages to hang on for a long time. But it's a good thing that you've got her as the person in distress, because Doc Ock doesn't know at that point what he's really doing. He doesn't know who she is anyway. He doesn't know that Spider-Man is Peter Parker at that point. But even if he did, he still wouldn't know who Aunt May is to Peter Parker. But there's that funny gag where she's hanging on forever and then she finally loses grip, but the ledge is inches away from her feet.
She could have let go anytime.
Oh!
Such a funny gag.
But the worst part of this movie is her unreasonable reaction when Peter says he's responsible for Uncle Ben being killed because he didn't stop the guy from stealing from the wrestling promoter.
She's like, you're right, you are responsible. It's ridiculous. But they just need to give him motivation to feel bad enough to become Spider-Man again.
And that pays off the third movie too, because the Sandman is involved in that killing. That's really forced in that third movie. That's one of the worst things about it. The Sandman character could have been great, but they wasted him. But anyway, she seems madder at him than she should. They do have a nice scene later on when she's moving out and she's talking with him and Henry, the neighbor, and all that kind of stuff. It's not Rosemary Harris's fault, but the way it's written is a little bit bizarre that she's mad at him, pulls her hand away. How dare you? Well, as you pointed out when we saw the movie, she doesn't know he's Spider-Man. If he tries to stop that guy from stealing from the wrestling promoter, he might have been killed.
Yeah.
Now, Uncle Ben being killed is terrible, but isn't it worse if your young nephew is killed?
Yeah.
One of my favorite lines ever that made you laugh was only a few days ago when we saw this movie. When he does save the young Asian girl in the building, when he's still having his powers problems, he can't actually be Spider-Man yet because he's impotent, effectively. He saves her, takes her outside, and you must be the parents, you're Asian.
Yeah, just gives a little girl to the first Asian couple he sees. Here you go, bye.
They're the only people out there that seem to be looking for any kind of kid, but still.
It's fine.
A little profiling. But I guess the red letter scene in the whole movie is the train fight, the subway, the elevated train. That sequence is fantastic in a lot of ways, the visual effects, the storytelling in general, where Doc Ock is fighting off Spidey for so long. And then a lot of the sequence that really stands out, though, is when Doc Ock is gone. When Spider-Man stops the train by just throwing a lot of webs out there and holding on as long as he can. Then he passes out, but they stop him from falling into the harbor. That's a great little moment. And then the Jesus-like pass along where he's being, not subtly, his arms are out. But then your arms flail out. But anyway, we've seen a lot of movies where people are in the Jesus pose, and he is
and
in this sequence.
They're reacting. They're saying, look at him. He's just a kid. Yep. Oh, my God.
And the thing that really touches me and almost makes me cry is when the two kids, who are apparently Tobey Maguire's nephews, I believe, or stepsons or something, they're the ones that find the mask and hand it to him and say, don't worry, we won't tell nobody.
That scene moves me every single time I see it. No matter how many times I've seen this movie, and no matter how much I know what's coming, when I talk about this film having pathos, I feel like 90% of it comes from this scene. The look on his face when he wakes up and he realizes he doesn't have his mask and he panics. And their universal reaction of, no, don't worry. We got your back. It's our secret. You're safe with us. We wouldn't do that to you. And that payback and the love that comes from the public that he's been working to save for all this time. I think it's been about 2 years. Maybe that's the first time he's ever really gotten to personally experience the appreciation. He needed their love back in order to literally survive in that moment.
In the first movie, I remember he's in peril with the Green Goblin, and it was not long after 9/11, and people are pelting the Green Goblin. Stay in New York, we're going to fight back. And maybe that was in the original screenplay, or maybe it's just lucky coincidence that it could be this whole sort of, we're going to rise up, because at that point, in mid-2002, not even a year after 9/11, people felt together still because things had not gone so downhill when it came to politics and war and whatnot.
That's a good point. And I've heard from people who lived in New York at the time that the attitude in New York changed and maybe has never really gone back to the old cynical ways, that New Yorkers really did change and start looking out for each other more after 9/11.
Which is probably one reason why that sequence was written into this movie. But a reasonably good question about that subway sequence is, why would a subway have the ability to go so fast in the first place?
Good question.
The superhero is doing all he can to stop it, and he's really not slowing it down very much until he finally, at the last second, does.
It's the same thing as speed, too.
We saw a subway out of control in that, too. And I talked about how there's a dead man switch in that. And you could argue that in both cases it doesn't work, but then it should just stop in both cases. It certainly shouldn't be that subways can go this fast. Although we've all been in a subway station before when a train goes by you and it's not stopping. And you think, or maybe actually the GO train here in Toronto, when it goes by, you think, oh my God, that thing is flying.
Yeah, you feel the pull if you're standing too close.
So maybe they go faster maybe they go faster than I think they do, but anyway. Okay, so the last sequence when Spider-Man and Doc Ock have their big moment, and of course Mary Jane finally realizes who Spider-Man really is. It is Peter Parker, and she'd kiss him in the first movie and all that. That pays off in the third movie too, when he kisses somebody else upside down, and that pisses her off. We've seen it before, punch up, but then there's also some intellectualism between two brilliant scientific people where he tries to convince Doc Ock, do the right thing, and he does, and he dies. But then another reasonably good question, does pollution in the river stop that tritium from killing everybody? Does the water put it out? Because it was about to destroy everybody. It was pulling cabs from what might be at least a few hundred feet away, possibly even miles away, pulling people in, and then it's just not an issue anymore?
I think even during the first experiment, that wasn't as big of a deal. They said it was generating 10,000 megawatts of surplus energy, but they're like, we can shut it all down, just pull the plug. I'm sorry, what? I don't know what kind of electricity they have in that lab, but I guarantee it's not 10,000 megawatts of surplus energy being generated. You can't just shut something like that down.
Spider-Man tries to by pulling the plugs. That's a nice sequence where he's using his Spider-Man feet, and he can stand there sideways and pull on the cables. But in that moment, of course, is when Rosalie dies. And Otto is really driven by that point. He has his Gollum moment where it's, no, I'm not a criminal. Ooh, but the real crime would be not to continue with my experiments.
Yeah.
But maybe I'm not that good to begin with.
That's another thing. There's a lot of people talking to themselves in this movie. And the first movie certainly guilty of that. There's a Gollum moment with Willem Dafoe.
Oh, yeah. Same year as when we saw Gollum in 2002. Mm. We'd seen him a little bit in the first Lord of the Rings movie, but he got his full character introduction in the second movie and has that great sequence where he's arguing with himself, and so does Willem Dafoe in the first Spider-Man film. So then Mary Jane knows about Peter, everything is settled, they're in love, but she's supposed to marry John Jameson, and she leaves him at the altar. But only in the movies do people leave others at the altar
in their wedding dress. I guess getting like a cool girlfriend who's super understanding is all it takes for him to get his powers back all the way and to solve all of his problems, because presumably at the end of the movie all of his problems are back, and that he logistically cannot go to school, make money, be a superhero, and have a girlfriend.
Well, when he's Spider-Man no more, you see him with the glasses back on and that fun moment where he has that little freeze frame.
So funny.
Raindrops are falling on my head.
That sequence is so funny.
But then his doctor does tell him that it's focusing on what he really wants. So I guess you could argue that when he's Spider-Man, he has to focus on being in that moment. And that's what he's trying to tell Mary Jane. I can't be with you because they will use you against me. And that's going to distract me and hurt you, maybe, which is even worse. But it's also going to hurt my ability to be a superhero. So I guess what he's saying is, when I'm Spider-Man, if I'm focused, I can have my web powers and I can have all these other talents. Which still, I think, is a little bit dubious. But it's a fun little moment. It's kind of like what happens in Superman 2. Where Superman has to decide, does he want to be in love or does he want to be with Lois Lane? Although not really, because he gives up his powers to be with her, but then she really wants Superman, not Clark Kent. And at the end of the film, he's got both again, but he makes her lose her memory so that she doesn't realize that she's in love with the same person that works with her at the newspaper. And again, a reporter in both cases, too. And the nerdy character. So yeah, Superman and Spider-Man have a lot in common. We've covered Tobey Maguire in Pleasantville, which I thought was pretty good in that as well, a couple years before this movie, well, about 6 years before. Love Him and Wonder Boys, that's a really good movie. And he's so intense in Brothers, not long after Spider-Man 2. But he barely works now. And I heard he's also supposed to be the basis of that Molly's Game movie.
Yeah, if you've seen Molly's Game or read Molly Bloom's book, then you probably already know that Player X, played by Michael Cera in the film, is based on Tobey Maguire and Leonardo DiCaprio. And that Maguire was definitely involved in a lawsuit over hundreds of thousands of dollars of winnings that turned out to be stolen money. I think they talk about that in Molly's Game. And he has a reputation that confirms that he is as much of a prick as he comes across in Molly's Game.
So maybe that's why he doesn't work much, because he has very few credits since 8 or 10 years ago.
It's amazing that someone who can appear that affable on screen has such a heinous reputation off screen.
I don't know if Leo really has that same reputation. They're friends. Not that they have to be the same person when they're buddies, but Leo seems to be the person that, for whatever he might be behind the scenes, maybe he's a dick, and we'll find out about that another 10 years from now. But politically, he seems to be saying and doing all the right things, and Tobey Maguire maybe not so much.
From what I understand, Leonardo DiCaprio knows how to play the game with the people where it matters, and Tobey Maguire has complained that he's just an introvert and he doesn't like networking and he just can't spend the time and energy on fostering relationships that would keep him a star, so now that saying, Leonardo DiCaprio can.
Now they're saying to hell with him. Well, he and Dunst have incredible resumes for people who haven't made that many movies. But I don't think a lot of people would say Maguire and Dunst are two of the greats of the business. And they're not. But their resumes, when you look at them, have got so many performances in lesser movies like Brothers for him or Melancholia for her that are strong performances that people don't really talk about now. And movies they should watch if they haven't seen. They're not easy to watch, but it shows their range. And I've said before, if you killed off half of Hollywood, two-thirds of Hollywood, there's so many people that could take over and be the stars, and they'd be as good or better as what we have now as our top stars. There's so many talented people in this business.
I feel like Dunst is on the cusp maybe of having a moment between her very lauded performance in season 2 of Fargo and her turn as a villain in Hidden Figures, which was a movie that had so many incredible performances. I think she kind of just blended into the background because there was just too much great stuff going on there. She's still in the mix, for sure. Mm.
The one thing that doesn't stand out in these movies at all, and I think he can be good, and other times he seems like he's so acting, if you know what I'm saying?
I think I know where you're going.
Is James Franco.
Yeah, dude.
He's got a great arc in these movies, probably a better arc than anyone else in the three movies, especially at the end, where he, spoiler alert, dies saving his friends. His character is becoming an alcoholic, which I guess maybe you could argue his father was, too. He's becoming his father as the arc plays out. There's a bit of a Me Too thing with him as well, but forgetting all that, just watching his film career, there's lots of times he's been good, and so many times where he hasn't been good. In these movies, he is so acting. Yeah. Hey, buddy, I hate Spider-Man. Hey, buddy, I hate Spider-Man. And then you see The Disaster Artist, which I watched again a few months ago, and I think, wow, as Tommy Wiseau, that might be the quintessential performance for James Franco of all time.
I disagree. I say his quintessential performance is 127 hours.
Also very strong, but not in these movies.
I totally agree. He's either really great, or how did he get cast in anything? Wooden, terrible. He just seems like he barely wants to be there. It's either Oscar worthy or it's that time he hosted the Oscars and completely blew it.
Yeah, right, sure. But Alfred Molina has been good for so long, including in Frida and then a lot of the PTA flicks. So memorable in Boogie Nights is the guy who's setting off fireworks. Well, actually, no, somebody else is doing that. But he's a drug dealer in that movie.
Motorin'.
Right. Rosemary Harris has been around for a long time, too, 61 years. And she actually acted with, we mentioned there a few minutes ago, Marissa Tomei. They're both in Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, a couple years after. Same year, actually, Spider-Man 3. The last movie Sidney Lumet ever made, and that's a terrific one, too. She is Philip Seymour Hoffman and Ethan Hawke's mother, and Tomei is Hoffman's wife. And she's fine as M.A., but Tomei is even better in the more recent films. And then Banks, who I have already raved about, small role in this, but Brightburn, my review of that is online. She's the mother in that film. I think she's pretty good in that.
I think I just saw that she's hosting the reboot of Press Your Luck.
Really?
Yes! How weird is that?
She'd be better than that.
I know!
No waste of her talents. Okay, well, we talked about Sam Raimi as the director. Great job, I think, with this movie. His writers, there's a lot of them. Alfred, I think it's Goff? Goo? Anyway, Michael Goff is the guy who plays Alfred in the Batman movies. Same spelling, so we'll say Goff. Miles Millar, or Miller, but with an A, so Millar. Michael Chabon? Chabon? I don't know how to pronounce these damn names. And Alvin Sargent, I don't know how to pronounce that name, with his two Oscars. And they're based, of course, on Stan Lee and Steve Ditko's comic book, which is one of the most famous things in the history of comic books. And the producers were Avi Arad and Laura Ziskin, but Stan Lee was an executive producer, along with, people might forget, Kevin Feige was an executive producer.
He
wasn't the guiding hand at this point. He's also an executive producer on Hulk, the Ang Lee one, the year before this. So even though people say he's got the Midas touch with this movie, okay, yeah, not so much with the year before with Hulk. But he wasn't really guiding them at this point. It was more Avi Arad and other people that had a big hand. And maybe that's why the more recent Marvel movies work so well, because it is him that's saying, this is our arc, guys.
You could say that he was obviously paying attention when he was on these sets to what worked and what didn't work. And I think it's safe to say that the tone that Raimi set with the Spider-Man trilogy was the model for the Kevin Feige Marvel-verse. It's that perfect balance of lovable characters, action set pieces with legitimate funny comedy, and just the right amount of irreverence, and he has the vision to keep everything remarkably consistent between all those movies, despite all the different writers, actors, directors that he works with. When he had the chance to pick and choose what kind of movie he wanted to make, what kind of universe, I think this is probably the movie that he pulled from.
And when I watch Endgame again, whenever that might be, probably on Blu-ray, I'll be on the floor in puddles because I'll be crying constantly. Kudos to him for this 11-year arc from Iron Man all the way to, well, I guess it's also including the new Spider-Man movie, but ending in a way that big series with Endgame.
But speaking of the series, I do want to talk about one of the reasons why I think Spider-Man 2 is better than Spider-Man 1 is it has the advantage of being a sequel and having all that world building done for it. Like, I think if you were going to make a list of the greatest superhero films, it would be mostly sequels. And that's not just because of volume of sequels that there are. It's because the best franchises and characters can really stretch out once they've unburdened themselves from the obligation of explaining the origin of the hero. Origin stories are interesting, but it's difficult to make a great action film when your hero spends the first half of the film as a pipsqueak or as Spider-Man or like a child like Batman. You need to do all the burdensome work of introducing too many characters or doing complex world building. So sequels get to just hit the ground running, and Spider-Man 2 definitely does. And then you get some of the greatest examples of the genre. You already mentioned X2, which before Logan, I'd say, was the best X-Men movie. Avengers Endgame, of course. Spider-Man 2, which for 4 years, many agreed was the best superhero film, until it was, of course, dethroned by another sequel, The Dark Knight.
We've covered now, I guess, 3 sequels before, if we ever do cover the original from that series. T2, we didn't cover the first Terminator, which I do love. Dark Knight, we didn't cover Batman Begins, or any of the previous Batman movies for that matter. And now Spider-Man 2 without covering Spider-Man, aiding to your point that the sequels are even better than the originals, at least in these cases.
You said Batman, so maybe I'll do the Batman.
Anyway, might hurt my throat. We're not quite done. So the movie's 2, 3, 5, 1. We watched the DVD, which I thought looked okay. The cinematographer, Bill Pope, we've seen him a ton this year because he worked on the Matrix series and Clueless, and we covered those earlier this year. He also, of course, did Spider-Man 3. The editor, Bob Murawski, did a lot of Sam Raimi flicks and also won the Oscar for The Hurt Locker in 2009, which we covered a couple of months ago. And the composer, Danny Elfman, who worked on Men in Black, which we covered just a few weeks ago. And, of course, Batman and so many more. Raimi and Elfman had a big falling out, though, on this movie. They would eventually work together again. But I guess part of the problem was Sam Raimi, according to Elfman, got too big for his britches. And yet the funny thing is that Sam Raimi, when he was on Hardwick's podcast, The Nerdist, or whatever he's calling it now, ID10T, I don't listen to his podcast anymore, so I forget. Anyway, it was a while ago. He seemed like the nicest guy. Hardwick would say, I like that movie. Well, thank you very much, every time. And yet, apparently, Raimi got too big for his britches with Elfman, and they didn't work together again for a long time until they did, with James Franco, Oz the Great and Powerful.
Oh, yeah, that was Raimi?
Yeah, and then Elfman came back to do the music for that.
I think it's really easy to be nice for 1 hour during a podcast with no stakes versus when you are arguing with an equally talented ego.
Fair, I'm just saying that in his answers, he didn't come across like, yeah, I made Spider-Man, Spider-Man 2. And revered movies like the Evil Dead films. And A Simple Plan, which is fantastic. He could have an ego and be a dick, and I don't think he was. So, anyway.
And also, isn't he responsible for Xena and Hercules?
He's a big producer. He's also produced a lot of horror movies. Yeah, he's been around for a long time, and he's had one hell of a career. But he hasn't made movies so much in the more recent era. And if he is actually a dick, and Elfman's right, then maybe he and Maguire have the same problem, where people said, you made Spider-Man 3, didn't succeed the way we thought it would, you're out! Because Hollywood does that sometimes, and it's usually to women. Or people who aren't white. But sometimes it's white guys, too.
Or people who are insufferable dicks.
Yeah,
or just don't want to play the Hollywood game. Who knows? There's so many stories behind the scene we'll never hear.
All right, then last thoughts on Spider-Man 2. The sequel. Whatever.
If the overwhelming amount of superhero content has led you to let this gem collect dust in your collection, then I recommend you revisit it because it's still delightful and all the jokes will seem fresh to you again.
If I had to pick a Spider-Man movie, this would certainly be on the short list. Well, I've only ever seen Spider-Verse once, so it's hard to say. Spider-Man 2 I've seen probably 4 times.
I have seen...
And Homecoming I've seen twice.
I've seen Spider-Verse more than once now, and it really holds up to second viewings. There's really no dispute that Dark Knight is the best superhero film, but I'm sure I've seen Spider-Man 2 more. I'm sure I've just, over the years, been more inclined to pick it up, put it in the player, and watch it on any given night than The Dark Knight.
There's always dispute. Incidentally.
I guess there's always dispute, but I don't agree. I really do believe that Dark Knight is the best superhero film.
But this was a lot of fun. This has been a fun month. We watched Men in Black, Speed, Up, and this. One of our more fun months ever, I would say. Four straight weeks of good times at the films. Okay, we're off next week to celebrate Canada Day. When we get back into your life on July 8th, we're going back half a century to when Sergio Leone released the classic Once Upon a Time in the West. I haven't seen this movie in a while, and I don't think you've seen it. I
saw it about 15 years ago, something like that, once.
The coming attractions trivia for Once Upon a Time in the West. Sergio Leone only directed 7 movies in a 23-year directing career. How many of those lucky 7 are members of the IMDb's top 250? The answer might surprise you, or it might not.
So for the answer to that question, please check out our next podcast about Once Upon a Time in the West. But if you can't wait until then, well, you can check out our website, top100project.com, where there's lots more Bevan Ryan to enjoy. Don't forget to favorite or subscribe to the Top 100 Project on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, where all of our over 300 episodes are available for free. And that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 list of the best American films ever made, and many, many more titles on top of that. In exchange for all this great content, perhaps you could leave us a rating and a review. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I am at Bev Ellis Ellis and Ryan is at MovieFiend51, or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we would like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee. Don't forget that you can enjoy a one-time 10% discount on any coffee purchase if you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout. That's all one word, TOP100PROJECT, and it is not case-sensitive.
Well, I've got a prop again, like I did with Doug when we did Up, and I've got my little Spider-Man guy. I got the dollar store years ago, and he's going to say, bye, everyone, rather than, hey, everyone, in Civil War.
And cut.